Another back in. So I talked to Shane, and this is the plan here. Is he said it's good to keep going, and what I'm going to do is going to keep going to 11:45 with my material, with whatever we get through, and then at 11:45 I'm going to ask Brian and Phoebe to come up and share their story some, and then have opportunity to ask questions. If you need to leave, you will not offend me by leaving whenever you want to leave. But we decided that I'll just keep going, and you are welcome to exit at your leisure. But that's the plan. Does that sound okay to everybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, just a couple of things to keep in mind. We talked about dopamine,
and this is one area of the brain where there's that positive reinforcement. So the fact that you keep going and going and going over time because it's rewarding. And so you seek out and do it more. But what a lot of people don't understand, there's also an area of the brain that's responsible for what we call the dark side of the brain, or that negative reinforcement. And again, this is an area in that middle part of the brain, specifically an area called the amygdala. And so the amygdala is the little button in our brain that releases catecholamines, which are chemicals that are stress chemicals. And these are the fight and flight chemicals. Whenever we're engaged in something that is scary, okay, these chemicals are released, and they either tell us to get frightened and stand where we are like a scared little bunny, hoping that the tiger, the bunny?
The hawk.
The hawk, thank you. The hawk doesn't see me, okay, or I need to run, or I need to fight, you know, and a rabid bunny who's going to fight that hawk. So that's where the amygdala releases, is the stress area, okay? And when our body, number one, some people are born because of their genetics with hyperactive amygdalas, and so they're naturally stressed. But over time, because of chronic substance use, what happens is that area of the brain gets bigger and bigger, becomes more and more uncomfortable. So you've got this double whammy. You've got not only the dopamine that's being released, and when you release dopamine over time, you get less dopamine, which I'll talk about, but then also the dark side of addiction is that you're constantly stressed, okay? And not only that, but then when you're going through withdrawal from a lot of these substances, is your body is releasing these stress hormones, which makes it even more uncomfortable. And then you can just see why it's so attractive to use again to take away all of these, all of this discomfort and all of this pain. So we see this actually in CAT scans and MRIs that have been done, images of the brain. So here's a normal brain that has a normal amount of dopamine receptors. And these are the neurons that are receiving dopamine. And you can see a normal brain. It's hard to see here. Can you guys see it? Can you just kind of see the red in there? Okay, that's normal dopamine receptors in a person who's not using. And then you see for somebody who's chronically using heroin, you see those red receptors are gone. And that means that what the brain does, right, God built our brain such that, for instance, when we're using dopamine or something that's releasing dopamine, over time, the brain's always trying to keep a balance. And so if the brain detects I've got too much dopamine happening over and over, I need to make less dopamine neurons. Okay, and so that's what you see here. What happens when the brain has less dopamine neurons? You want more, but you're not experiencing any pleasure. So there's this dark cloud that is over your entire existence because things that should be giving you pleasure aren't giving you pleasure because you don't have the dopamine to do it. Okay. And also, what's fascinating is, and this is some of the imaging studies that we do, for instance, in our deep brain stimulation studies, is that there's these cues that elicit dopamine that would be apart from the drug. But with, for instance, I could show, or actually even more powerful, is patients who inject heroin will tell me that when they stop or they can't find heroin, they'll get out a needle and inject water. And that gives them a rush. And why is that? It's because that needle and that action is creating that dopamine. It's that anticipation of the substance. And the other killer is this. they never experienced the same degree of high that they experienced when they first were using. So they are always chasing that first experience and never getting it either. Talk about Sisyphus.
When the brain has been rewired and it's created these new tracks, is that damage permanent?
So, great question. And the answer is no. Okay, that the brain can rewire over time. We know that. Okay, with abstinence, the brain can rewire. Now, when you're stuck with your genetics, you're stuck with your genetics. Okay, but there is nothing that is, you're never damned, right, by your genetics or those types of choices. That you can get better, the brain can change over time if given the opportunity, and you do new behaviors. Okay, so remember, right, those tracks happen because of genetics, but also because of the behaviors. If you do new behaviors, healthy behaviors, then you start rewiring the brain again. The other thing is the amygdala. You can see here is a normal amygdala. It's smaller, okay? This is the fight and flight stuff, but for somebody who's chronically using heroin, look how much bigger it is. Okay? Cues, we won't talk about cues too much other than, you know, 12-step programs that talk about people, places, and things. These are all the cues that are associated with use, that just like that needle was associated with using heroin, all of these certain people, certain places, purple things, you need to avoid because those things are going to trigger you, trigger those, get the bells and whistles going in your brain that are going to keep you doing what you don't want to do. If anybody doubts the power between our vision and our mind and our bodies, right? You think about the steak, right? I know, doesn't it? You could hear it sizzling on the grill, right? It's sort of the pops in there, right? Good. Right now is a great time to be talking about this, right? Before lunch. Okay, you can almost smell it, right? And something's happening internally in you. Some of you, your mouth is watering right now, right? Mm-hmm. Some of you, your stomach is gurgling. Mm-hmm. I bet some of you, your pulse has increased, okay? And did anything physically happen? Mm-hmm. No, all you did was see an image, okay? Does this do the same thing? I suspect even you hardcore vegetarians, you're not triggered by this. Alright, so that's the brain. But remember, we are more than just brains on sticks. Okay, we're human beings. And we are biologically, socially, spiritual, psychological creatures. Okay? Stephen King, as you know, maybe you don't know this, but Stephen King is a recovering alcoholic. Somebody has alcohol use disorder. And quote in one of his books, the way beating heroin is child's play compared to beating your childhood. Isn't that a powerful quote? So development of addiction is impacted by external drivers, the culture we live in, the family we're born in and raised in, the religion that we experience. Either typically religion has through a number of studies, being part of a religious community is protective, okay, for a lot of this stuff. The peer group that we associate with, the role models we have, positive reinforcement. So one of the criticisms of the scientists who were doing the cocaine studies with the rats, right? One of the criticisms is, well, that rat is choosing the cocaine because you got him stuck in a foot box, right? Like a 12-inch by 12-inch box. And what else is he going to do? You would just sit there and hit that cocaine level too if you were stuck in that. And they proved that if you get this through this rack cart experiment where you create a floor probably about half the size of this room and you create tunnels for them to go to, you know, little amusement parks for them to walk through, you give them female rats that are dressed and have makeup on and things like this. And it gets really exciting. And those rats, they don't choose the cocaine pellets the way, or the cocaine lever the way the other rats did, because they're stimulated with natural rewards and they've got problems to solve and they've got ladies to woo and they've got other things that they want to do. Okay? Poetry to write. You know, things like that. Okay, and so that was a great example of it's not just
That was a great example of how important the environment is and the opportunities one has in an environment. Another natural experiment occurred when in the Vietnam War. Anybody hear of Operation Golden Flow in the Vietnam War? Okay. So some of you are probably aware that heroin became a problem for our GIs out in Vietnam. And out in Vietnam, heroin was readily available. And you can imagine in that kind of environment, out in the jungle, where you are stressed to the max, where your amygdala is in overdrive all the time, how pleasurable it would be to escape with heroin for a while. Okay, and so unfortunately, we had a number of our GIs who then got quote unquote hooked on heroin and couldn't bring them home because they were hooked on heroin. So President Nixon at the time decided that, you know what, we're going to do this. We're going to call it Operation Golden Flow. And in order to come home, you have to have a negative urine drug screen from opioids. Okay? And that was enough. So they knew that. That was enough to go home. They could stop heroin and then come home. And those GIs, they followed over time, and they didn't return to heroin. Okay? Because they got home, and they were back in a safe environment, and they were able to go to work. And so I don't know about this, but I suspect still a lot of those guys probably turned to alcohol when they got back to deal with a lot of their problems and their trauma and all of that stuff. But at least they didn't go back to heroin. Adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. How many have heard of this before? Okay, just a couple. So this is a very important concept to understand. Kaiser Permanente, big medical outfit out of California, 20 years ago, did some important research that looked at a number of variables that were adverse variables in childhood that predicted the risk of diseases later on, okay? And it shows the importance of the environment someone is in that leads to healthcare outcomes. Did you grow up in a household where you were physically abused or witnessed physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse? Was there neglect? Were you not given food and water and shelter? Were you emotionally neglected by your parents or your caregivers? Was there a lot of household dysfunction? Did you have mental illness in your family that was untreated? Was your mother treated violently by her partner while you were growing up? Did you have a father or a mother or another caregiver who was incarcerated? Was there substance use occurring in your home readily? Did you grow up in a divorce home? Each one of these are criteria that weighted together, either individually or a certain number, can predict your risk of having a disease. And what does that adverse childhood experiences? So if you have four or more of these ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, you're three times more likely than somebody who didn't to have both smoking and lung disease as an adult. You're 14 times more to attempt suicide, 4.5 times more likely to develop depression, 11 times more to develop IV drug use, 4 times more likely to begin sexual intercourse before age 15, 2 times more likely to have liver disease. Adverse childhood experiences are the single greatest unaddressed public health threat facing our nation today. 67% of the population have at least one of these adverse childhood experiences. People with a score of 6 or more, they can die 20 years earlier than somebody who doesn't. Okay? And 1/8 of the population have more than 4 of these. And so when we think about, right, what the church has an opportunity to do for our children and the children in our community, right, this is a great opportunity to help them into their adulthood by what we're able to do. You have a comment or question?
Yeah, what about the condition where they experience a death of a parent?
A death of a parent? That wasn't recorded. That didn't rise to the level that would affect these outcomes. So I'm not sure where it would. I bet there is some measurement, but it didn't rise to the level that these did.
Could you go over the list real quickly of what they are?
Yeah, what they are?
Yeah.
Yep. So again, real quick,
you can look at it.
Yeah.
Okay, and you can look these up too, okay? It's very common now, and most of this is taught typically in medical school and other public health institutions now.
I would take his example would be there's an emotional neglect and like divorce, losing a parent at an age that you're dependent on, something like.
It could, right? The important thing is if somebody loses a parent, that there's somebody in their life who is providing everything else that they need and is also demonstrated as a good role model. Okay? You guys know who J.D. Vance is?
Yeah.
Dobili Elegy? Elegy?
Yeah.
Right? So he had like something like 6 ACE scores growing up, 6 of those. But he also had a grandmother in his life who was very protective. He talks about that in his book, right? Very protective and not the best role model, but somebody who was looking out for his well-being, and that seemed to be enough for him to be able to succeed. Some would wish he didn't succeed, but that's okay.
Let's take an example of emotional neglect. Isn't that somewhat subjective? I mean...
Yeah, so it is. It is, right? And remember, they're asking how they're getting this information and how they got it would be adults that are asking them to look back on their childhood and what they experienced, right? And so there is some subjectivity to this, to that, sure. So biopsychosocial is kind of what we've been talking about. And we've got all these variabilities. I'm going to talk about spirituality for a moment. This is one of the best books that I've ever read on healthcare and the state of healthcare and what we need to do to change healthcare these days. It's called From Hostility to Hospitality, Spirituality and Professional Socialization Within Medicine by the Balbonis. The Balbonis are at Harvard. Michael Balboni is a chaplain and a professor at Harvard University, and then Tracy is a family medicine professor and clinician at Harvard. And they've teamed up to write, what I consider to be probably the most important book regarding healthcare right now and spirituality. So highly recommend it. It's dense, and just know that if you're going to get it, but it's worth trying to get through if you're interested in this particular topic. They find spirituality as life-centered in the person or objects of one. So everybody, right, how many times do you hear, I'm spiritual but not religious these days, right? So everybody says they're spiritual now. And guess what? They are. And what this book, you know, and others, you know, talk about is everyone is spiritual. Okay? The question is, because everyone has affections and desires that they are placing on something else as the main source and the main fount of their life's passion and what's driving them. So everybody, I would say, yeah, you are spiritual, but you know what you're talking about. But everyone is spiritual. Life-centered in the person or objects of one's chief love. Okay. However, it's individually understood and pursued, right? So it doesn't necessarily say anything about that object of the person's love, but it's your love for that object is what we're talking about, the spirituality. And who was it that said something about a man is measured by what he loves the most? You guys know what I'm talking about? Okay, I can't remember who it is, but that's what it's kind of getting at. But that's spirituality. And then religion is the individual and social structures that flow from and facilitate a chief love, including beliefs, practices, relationships, and organizations. So everybody's also religious. Okay? And if you don't believe that, watch March Madness. If you don't think people who aren't going to church are religious, watch March Madness. Watch the Super Bowl. Watch the Taylor Swift concert. Okay, if you don't think there's external forms and structures to what's happening here, you are not paying attention. Okay, and if we can start thinking about this, and when this is in medicine too, by the way, is there are practices, etc., that are religious. So the chief love is not only it's not just what we're thinking. Okay. But it's also our will, and it's also our emotions, our affect, that drive us towards this chief love. And the chief love evokes these things from us. It's the center, and it's organized to how a person's life is actually lived in relation to the object. It's inherently self-referential. Again, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do about the quality of that chief love, but it's what we are doing
towards that chief love, and the affections we have towards it. There's a constructive and necessary relationship with religion. So spirituality is the underlying affection of the heart. It's invisible, where religion is the public-facing outworking of that and experiences of that love. It's visible. So religion is spirituality expressed in human forms of practices, relationships, organizations, and supporting beliefs. Okay? And again, why am I talking about this? Again, because one could, and I think I do, would conceptualize ongoing addiction as a religion and spiritual experience. Resist false, so there's a false dichotomy of, well, that's individual versus versus collective. I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. Yeah, but and so it's just all about me. No, it's not, because everyone else in your community is doing just what you're doing, and you're doing it together. And it's inner, and also this thing that's either it's just an inside thing versus no, everything you do has outward consequences and visibility. Okay, so this is REM. How many are familiar with REM? And so I was thinking about this when I first put this together, this slide, and going through this. But here would be an example. And when I read these lyrics to you, think about this person whose religion is heroin and is thinking about stopping heroin. Okay, and his spirituality, his greatest affection is to chase the dragon, chasing the heroin as well. Okay, here's the lyrics. Oh, life is bigger. It's bigger than you, and you are not me. The lengths that I will go to, the distance in your eyes. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight, losing my religion, trying to keep up with you, and I don't know if I can do it. Oh no, I've said too much. I haven't said enough. Every whisper of every waking hour, I'm choosing my confessions, trying to keep an eye on you. Like a hurt, lost, and blinded fool, oh no, I've said too much. I set it up. Consider this, the hint of the century. Consider this, the slip that brought me to my knees. Fail. What if all these fantasies come flailing around? Now I've said too much. And then, now you start humming. Who's humming? Go ahead. Theology. So reflection of what one fundamentally believes to be true about reality. And that reality shapes how we live, what we consider to be important, that which deserves our time, and where our affection is centered. If spirituality refers to what is chiefly loved, and religion is in reference to the structure supporting that chief love, then theology is reflection and reasoning that springs out of a relationship and experience of that chief love. So practical theology, this was a picture that they used, the doctor, that historically religion, specifically Christianity in the West, of course, was seen as the driving force behind hospitals, right? I mean, that's, we just know that, okay? And that there was, that illness was a sanctified state where God was especially present in our suffering, in our vulnerability, in our illness, rather than absent. Right, and our modern healthcare system has done the opposite. Where you want to not find God, usually it's in the hospital. Rather than sort of our modern idea of we're suffering, is it's because God's rejected us, right? But that's not the way many of the folks back who were building hospitals saw. They saw this as a space where you meet God in ways that you wouldn't have met God before. And the care of the sick was a high privilege and honor because you were able to share that suffering and you were able to enter that space where God was being with somebody in a special way that they wouldn't have been with somebody who was healthy at the time. And a belief in a rational God undergirds the scientific method as opposed to being at odds with the scientific method, right? And now today, all of that is divorced, and it's the scientific method is just hung in midair with nothing that girds it. This was a fantastic, how many people know this book, You Are What You Love by James K. A. Smith? So this is an incredibly rich book. If you haven't read it, let me encourage it to you. It also kind of
gives voice to much of what I've been saying regarding our chief loves and how the world around us also is religious and is enforcing and shaping through its own structures that we're not aware of to worship whatever it is the world wants us to worship. You don't get over an addiction by stopping using. You recover by creating a new life where it is easier to not use. If you don't create a new life, then all the factors that brought you to your addiction will catch up with you again. All right? So when you are thinking about trying to help somebody who's suffering from addiction, you need more than the Nancy Reagan model of just stop using. Just say no. Okay. Mm-hmm. You need to help them find something more important, more beautiful than what it is that they're doing, and help them shepherd them along to help them get there. All right, so very important then is I'll go ahead and likely wrap up then talking about treatment and what you need to know regarding just treatment in general for addiction. So you can think about somebody who's using a substance as into four different buckets along the spectrum, okay? So somebody is using a substance. So are they not using at all? Are they a teetotaler? They've never drank alcohol, or maybe they drank alcohol a long time ago, but they don't anymore. That would be the abstinent bucket. So abstinent bucket, you just don't even have to worry about this person with an addiction because they're abstinent. They haven't used, they don't plan on using. Unless they start using, then that changes. Then there's people who are using, but they're using in ways that it's not causing problems or significantly clinical distress, maladaptive. So non-problematic use, okay? So they could be drinking, they could be smoking, whatever, but it's not causing them problems. That's one bucket. And then there's another bucket that they might fall into where they're using in such a way, either the amount, the frequency, or the setting and the dangerousness or the potential dangerousness where they're at risk. And they're either at risk of going further along the spectrum into an addiction or that risk for having particular consequences for their substance use, like liver failure, okay, or contracting an infectious disease, or you know, being at risk for drunk driving, these sort of things. Okay, so they might not have an addiction, but they're used in such a way that they could be at risk. And then the fourth and final bucket would be, do they have a substance use disorder? Okay? And each of these, I mean, the tack that you will take for each of these would be different. I'm not going to go through the numbers, but this is the most recent data. If anybody ever wants to see the data, then SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, puts out data from thousands upon thousands of people, surveys every year, called a National Substance Use, Drug Use, and Health Report. And you can look at that on the internet and see what numbers of people, but very high rates. So when you're thinking about care for addiction, treatment, okay, formal treatment for addiction, okay, you can think about it in this way. From the least intensive to the most intensive level of treatment, a pyramid. Okay, most people, well, let me ask you this. Where do you suppose most people with an addiction are getting help for their addiction for? Most people in the United States, if they have an addiction, and they've recognized they have addiction, and they're getting help for it, where are they getting it?
Their family doctor.
Nope.
Nope.
Internet. Nope.
AA.
AA. 12-step programs.
$1.
That's right. So that's where most people are getting their addiction care from. Okay? And then next would be, could be the family doc. Could be the family doc. If the family doc is screening for it or the patient has identified that they have a problem. But then the next would be outpatient counseling. So somebody who is seeing a counselor because they have an addiction problem. Okay, so that's the least intensive. So usually it would be once a week or even several times a week for an extended period of time. What that time would be, I don't know. And then the next more intensive would be, in addition to that counseling, seeing a physician. So it could be a family physician, it could be a psychiatrist like myself, it could even be a nurse practitioner or a PA, where they are going for medical appointments because they're doing some medical treatments, like taking medications for addiction. Okay? Did you have a question?
I have a family member in a methadone clinic.
Yeah. I'll talk about that because I think it's really important too that people know about that. And then next would be what's called a day hospital or intensive outpatient program. And what that is, it's a higher level of care than just a regular medical doctor's appointment. And what this is usually, especially with the IOPs or the intensive outpatient programs, usually it's a couple of hours, 3 days a week. Okay? So usually, like ours, for instance, that we run is Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday from 4 to 6 or 4 to 7. And what you do is it's a lot of group-based treatment. And you see a therapist, a counselor, as well as a physician to manage any of the medications that you may need for your addiction and other problems, too. And usually that's a 90-day program, typically, and that's what insurance is for, usually pay for a 90-day program. Okay? If you need more help than that, than any of this, then typically the next higher level of care would be going into what most people know of as called a 28-day program. Or what is technically defined in healthcare as a residential treatment center. Okay, and this is where you go for 28 days and you live and breathe recovery, okay, with a whole bunch of other people who are living, breathing recovery while you were outside of your regular environment and you're being monitored that full time. And you have a lot of group therapy, you have hopefully you have a really good care during that program. So that could be an option as well. And then for the rare folks who have really bad addiction, is what I mean by this, is where they've got, and what I mean, because John was asking me about, what do you mean by really bad addiction? Isn't all addiction really bad? But what I mean by that is, has your addiction got a hold of you such that it's causing physical problems or psychological problems that need to be acutely treated in a hospital setting? So are you at risk for having severe withdrawal from alcohol, for instance, which can happen, where you could die if you go through withdrawal? Are you hallucinating? Are you suicidal? All of these things, that may require you to go into a hospital bed and get treated for that. Usually it's not a long time, usually a week at the most, unless it's really, really severe. Some folks who have really severe alcohol problems will have to treat for much longer than that to get them into a safe zone so that they can then go to do any of this stuff, okay? So that is the full spectrum of care in a nutshell for somebody who has addiction. Any thoughts, questions about that?
When you have a group in a residential setting all be treated at the same time.
Yeah.
Is there a better model than that, where like they wouldn't be with other people recovering, or is that a good thing for them to be with other people? In other words, if with healthy things, examples.
Yeah, I think it's a really good thing. So much of the treatment that we offer in our programs, much of it is group-based. We offer individual stuff, of course, so we see a lot of patients individually, but much of it is group-based, because what we're trying to do is help with the isolation that people experience. We're helping build those connections. And then also, so much of it is, it's not rocket science. Everyone has the same questions. Everyone has the same problem. Everyone thinks they're unique, right? Everyone thinks that they are unique. But in reality, everyone's got the same problems. And so then you're starting to hear, oh, wait a second, this person's got this. Wait, this, and also, wow, how were they able to stay sober now for 5 days? Maybe I can, okay? So I'm a big fan of group-based care.
I wonder what you think about church-based recovery programs.
Okay. So I am a big fan of community-based recovery programs, whether they be secular or church-based. And it really just depends. And so you've heard, of course, AA and NA, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, but there's also the church-based programs. The most common one is called Celebrate Recovery. And there's another one called Reformers Unanimous. But there's a whole bunch out there. And it really depends, right? And I think what I try to help people understand, go to as many as you can, find out what makes the best sense for you, and make that, you know, part of your life. And if you're uncomfortable and you don't like it, good. Keep doing it. Okay, that means it's probably working. But what I also tell people too, who are Christians, is do not neglect your church responsibilities and obligations and the fellowship you have in your church to do this. So if you're going to go to AA, and I try to get every patient of mine who has alcohol use disorder into AA, everyone. And I encourage you to do that. But don't stop going to church and seeing church as your primary family.
Do you know much about rational recovery?
Oh, yeah, I do.
What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I also like what they do. And rational recovery is sort of an alternative to the faith-based, spirituality-based 12-step programs. You know, so AA is anything near what we would consider an orthodox Christian base. But a lot of people outside of our circles see it as a Christian-based program, okay? It's not. But rational recovery is basically sort of a response to that. I don't want to go to AA because they talk about God, a higher power, right? Where rational recovery doesn't. They just use a lot of cognitive-based therapy models that are very helpful and accomplish a lot of the same things, but they don't get into that kind of the community. Again, there is a community that's being built up, right? But you see what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So I think it's go try different things and see how they work.
Jim, you've talked a bit about the creating a life, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Essentially an application of Ephesians and Colossians, put on.
Yeah. Right? Yep. Yeah, and so when I gave my course at Westminster, I used those very terms for the students to meditate upon. You got it. Anything else? Yeah.
How do you convince people in Christian circles that you can't just, you know, stop doing this, or it's just a sin problem? Yeah, it's a sin problem, but how do you convince them that they have to take more steps? They have to either go on vacation, they have to go to one of these things.
Yeah, my that's a great question, right? My hope is that I have given you some fodder today by which you will be able to construct your own arguments and articulate that very thing to those folks, okay? So what I'm hoping that I've done today is to say that, listen, there are powerful biologic forces, there are powerful genetic forces, there are powerful social forces at work that keep people using it, and these are the things that need to be done to try to help somebody. So that's my hope.
What do non-Christian people put their hope in exactly when they...
Runs the gamut, right? It runs the gamut. And I won't even... Yeah, so it's just, you name it, and then people put their hope in all manner of things.
I mean, for recovery, I'm asking. But themselves?
Yeah, a lot of it is themselves, right? Now, the thing I like about AA and NA is you are you're giving yourself up to a higher power. Right now, I don't like the higher power terminology, but at least what it does, it's getting you outside of yourself, okay? And Brian, you want to say something about it?
Yeah. So one big thing that they say in NA and AA is, I get drunk, we stay sober. Or I get high, we stay clean. So it's a big fellowship.
It emphasizes the community, right, and the strength that one has in being part of the community.
Yes.
So it helps with that isolation and also the obligation you have to the other person in the group that, you know what, I'm thinking about using right now, taking another drink, but then I gotta go back to that meeting tomorrow and I gotta face my peers that I drank.
And it's very much like if you think of like the body of Christ and when a member is in sin and or the way that we build each other up and encourage each other. It's very much, I guess, like that in mm-hmm. that sense, yeah. Just without Jesus.
So. Yep. So I see it as a common grace blessing,
mm-hmm.
you know, that people who don't have God yet can share.
Jim, you mentioned a number of books that folks might want to get hold of, you know, Kelly K. hostility to hospitality. Could you, in some other way, make available for us a list of those books?
Sure. Yeah, I could send them to you or Shane or John.
That'd be good.
Yep.
Yeah. And also, we talked earlier, mentioning a book on the loneliness, and particularly with genes. There's a book by Gene Twenge, or Twenge, T-W-E-N-G-E, and the title of the book kind of says it all. It's titled iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and What That Means for the Rest of Us. And I recommend that for any parents of young children, before teens.
So we can add that to the list.
Pardon me?
So we can add that to the list.
And also, there's a book, the author's name is Strunk or Strunk, something like that, but the title is Wired for Intimacy, How Pornography Rejects the Man.
I haven't read that, but I've heard that's a good one, too.
Yeah.
Let me just real quick, since you mentioned it, we're not going to go through all this opium stuff, other than let you know that it's the leading cause of overdoses. And sadly enough, you could just see how impactful it's been. You may have heard of something called fentanyl. So fentanyl is an opioid that's made in a lab that is 100 times more potent than heroin. All the heroin in the streets of West Virginia now is fentanyl. There's no heroin left. It's just all fentanyl. And so we have people who are dying at record amounts. And one of the tools that is going to be absolutely essential and has been in keeping people alive is these medications to help with heroin and pain pill and opioid addiction. And so what is the two main goals that you have for people who are suffering from any addiction and the diseases of despair? One, keep the person alive. Can we all agree that this is at least a noble and goal that we have for people, is to keep them alive? You cannot treat a dead person. Okay? So what can, when we're thinking about options and tools and strategies for somebody who has addiction, let's keep them alive. And two, how about we try to help them increase the quality of life that they are living? So what are the options that we have to help them do that? When you look for specifically for opioid use disorder, heroin addiction, pain pill addiction, fentanyl addiction, okay, there's three basic options. One is just to get detoxed, just to go in and get detoxed. It rarely works over the long haul. It does work for some people, but it rarely works over the long haul. There's a 95% relapse rate just getting detoxed. Detox and going into a 28-day program sometimes works, okay? About a 90% relapse rate for doing that. Okay. Medications for opioid use disorders and medications for addiction treatment is recognized now as the best chances to keep people alive. And so one of the participants here said that they have a family member in methadone. So methadone is one of those. There's another medicine called Suboxone and another medicine called Naltrexone or Vivitrol. These medicines, folks, are the most critical tools that we have to keep people alive for their addiction and increase their quality of life. There's a lot of stigma associated historically with using these medicines. And I want to help you understand that these are critical tools. The same way that somebody might need insulin for their diabetes, the same way that somebody may need Prozac for their severe depression, okay, people need these medicines to stay alive. And whatever we can do to help people get access to it, it is absolutely proven, I'm not going to get into this,
that it does. It lower rates of return to opioid use, improves social functioning, decreases people's likelihood to inject drugs, it improves their quality of life, it keeps people out of prisons and jails, and it decreases healthcare costs. Okay? Now, at the same time, all of these things are just a tool. Tools can be used responsibly, tools can be used irresponsibly. Okay? But it's just a tool. I will go ahead and stop there, and I'm going to then have Brian and Phoebe stay back there because everyone can see you back there. You're already seated. So at this point, I'm going to stop my formal presentation and just invite a conversation with some of my dear friends who are members of Reformation Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And if you all, whoever needs to get up and leave, you can do that. But we'll just spend some time conversing and letting them share their story. And then they can answer any questions you have. And I can answer any questions that I've given you to talk about today. Okay?